This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, hearing from 92-year-old World War II fighter pilot and ex-prisoner of war, Ray Maloney. He lives in Connecticut part of the year, Florida the rest. He's originally from New York. But on November 5th, 1944, a week before his 22nd birthday, Ray's P-47 was shot up by German anti-aircraft guns. He tried to keep the sputtering plane flying, but realized that wasn't going to happen, and he bailed out just seconds before it went down. A couple questions to follow up on what you shared before the break. Two things, Ray.
A, your chute never opened, but yet you survived.
Partially.
Or never fully opened, it, yeah. Yet you survived. Maybe that is miraculous.
Yeah.
B, had you waited one more second?
Yeah, I wouldn't have had any room to bail out. I would have had to try to crash into the side of the... There was no place down there that was flat.
1 second, you know? And you would have been gone. Well, never would have seen your wife again. Three kids, 9 grandkids, 5 great-grandkids. Wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I didn't think about those at the moment.
Yikes.
Yeah, I think... And I've since... Not because of that episode, but now that I'm old and closer to my maker, I've gotten religion, and I now go to church every Sunday, trying to make amends.
So you hit the ground, and you mentioned your heels and your rear end. How long was it till you started feeling some pretty severe pain?
Oh, immediately. Right away. I couldn't stand up. It was that painful. I was on my hands and knees, and the Germans, they sent a patrol up, 6 or 7 men, and I could tell that they were looking for me. You know, they were pointing and talking. There's part of it I don't want to talk about, but within about 10 minutes or so, I was out of ammunition, and one guy said, stand up in English, and I tried to stand up, and I closed my eyes. I thought, I'm going to get killed right now, and the only German words I could think of was kaput. You know, and I said, kaput, kaput. And so they came over, and they recognized that I was on my hands and knees. I could barely move. And so it still was very painful, but they took 2 rifles, and I sat on the 2 rifles and put my arms around these 2 Germans, and they carried me maybe 400 or 500 yards to some little dugout where they had, were spending the night. They had a little straw in a little tiny roof thing there, and I spent the night there. And then the next day, took me down to some little medical facility that Germans had. And I spent, I think, 2 days there. And they put a big piece of canvas from groin to up under my arms to try to support my back. And I started my sojourn up to Germany.
I'm sure everyone listening right now is in the same boat as I am, thinking, how in the world would I feel in that situation? What would be going through my mind? So you're on your hands and knees. You can't stand up. And I don't want to prod you to talk about things you're not comfortable with. But clearly you're trying to defend yourself in the situation you're in with a .45, I suppose, that you had.
Yeah, I fired it, yeah.
And then you're going to be captured. You already told us you never considered being a POW. It was, I'm going to finish my missions or I'm going to die.
Yeah, right.
So now here you are, 21 years old, in that situation. How scared were you?
I was scared skinny. you do what you're trained to do, but when you're facing, your maker, you're probably not thinking properly anyway. But
And I imagine there was no assurance for you that these Germans capturing you are going to treat you right.
Oh, no, you're in the land of the unknown now. It could happen any time, yeah.
Yet they did give you medical attention.
The military, yeah. I think if when you're in the hands of the Germans, certainly, you're better off with the military. You're safer. In fact, when I was brought up into Germany, we were traveling on train for a while, and we got into Munich late, it was evening time. It was dark. I guess it was the 15th Air Force that just finished bombing Munich, and part of it was the railroad yards
right. In
Munich. And our train had to wait outside for an hour or so to go in. And then we had to change trains in Frankfurt. And there was one other South African pilot with me that They brought us up together, and two guards. And the two guards told me, take the wings off, because we'll be going through the station in Munich. And 15th, they just bombed the hell out of it.
So know? Those civilians
and
are going to
so
be pretty angry.
So they were protecting me by taking my wings off. They said, if the civilians see you, they'll kill you. You know, so
those guys didn't need to tell you that. That's pretty humane of them to do so.
Yeah, but you know how you can't blame the Germans either. We were killing them by the thousands, and it's wartime, and that's the name of the game.
I mentioned you were shot down a week shy of your 22nd birthday. How'd you spend that birthday? I imagine that birthday's pretty unique among the 92 that you've had.
Yeah, I was in. Now I said the basement, but I was in the basement for a while. In a house in Verona, and then they moved to the second floor, and the day of my birthday was on the second floor, locked in a room, all by myself, and I was hanging out the window looking at the downspout, the rain downspout, and I was trying to decide whether it was strong enough to try to go down that. There was another drain that you know, fed into that drain, and I felt at it, and it was kind of loose. And I thought, if I grab that thing, I'll probably end up, you know, two floors down on the ground. And so I didn't do it, but I was standing there entertaining the idea if I could climb down that drain spout, I might be able to get out of here. But I didn't do it because I didn't think the thing would hold me.
You were plotting your own great escape, huh?
Yeah, right. It was on my birthday.
And I'm sure, again, people can empathize and understand how your mind has to go in a million different directions when you're in a situation like this. So much uncertainty. And you mentioned them transporting you. I'm sure eventually you were interrogated.
Oh, yeah.
The Dulag Luft.
The Dulag, yeah.
The infamous interrogation center. Yeah. So when they brought you in, what did they say to you? How did that conversation unfold?
Well, we hadn't eaten when we departed from Italy. They gave us a little package of some sandwiches and hard bread, you know, and stuff, and sausage. And they didn't tell us how long this would have to last. And so Stan, South African fellow's name with me, Stan Gray, that was his name. We figured it was a one-day supply of food, and the next day we get in. Well, we ate that one day, and we were now into the third day without any food. So by the time we got to the Dulag, it was late at night, and we hadn't had anything to eat for going on 2 days. It wasn't quite 2 days. And so we said, you know, we're hungry. And they said, well, the kitchen is closed tomorrow. So Stan went one way, and I was sent another way, and that was the last I ever saw Stan. But you end up in this little 8-by-4-foot cubicle with a little tiny bunk in it. There was a thing on the doorway that you turned, and one way it had a Red Cross for medical, if you had medical problems. And so I went to sleep on the bunk, and in the morning I turned this thing, and I was there for 10 days, and nobody ever came to see me with the back. And there'd be a knock at the door, and the door would open, and the guy would hand you a piece of brown bread cut very thin with a kind of a swipe of jelly on it, or jam rather, and then a little cup of coffee, ersatz coffee, fake coffee. I don't know what they were making it out of. And so, you know, I'm waiting for the eggs and bacon, and that was it.
It wasn't coming.
It wasn't coming, you know. And so, and then in the evening, you got two meals. In the evening, you got a little bit of sausage and a little thicker piece of bread, and again another little tiny half cup of this awful coffee, and that was all you had. And so for 10 days you get that once a day, you know, in the morning and at night.
In a 4-foot by 8-foot room, and I'm sure people are thinking 4 feet by 8 feet. Mm. That's tiny. You can barely stretch your arms
out.
Tiny,
yeah. It's small in this room. Yeah.
For 10 days. That's got to be a long 10 days.
Oh, I tell you, then there's no windows. You know, there's nothing. And there were probably dozens, hundreds of these rooms. I don't know how many. But and they let you cool your heels for a week or so until you're dying to talk to somebody, you know, something. And then they take you out. And I was questioned with some officer. He knew what group I was from. He knew what squadron I was from. And he had a book with lists of missions and stuff, photographs. I was absolutely shocked. And he showed me a picture of four pilots, and I was one of them. Yeah. And he knew there was something about that mission, and he wanted to know what that mission was. Well, as soon as I saw the four guys, I knew what it was. The mission had flown its 2,000th sortie. And that night, we had a little party about it. But I told him, I said, I don't know. I flew a bunch of missions. I don't know what one you're talking about and everything.
So this had been a news clipping that they had added to their collection of intel.
Yeah, it had these four. Not a news clipping. It was a photograph, you know, a little photograph. I don't know where the hell it came from, but... I was in it. There was four guys, and there I am standing there in flight gear still, you know, like we had just come back.
So a photo taken on your base that wasn't published anywhere still found.
That he had on that book. Yeah.
Tells you how good their intelligence network was, huh?
Yeah, it was amazing.
I've had a lot of POWs tell me that the air interrogators knew more about them than they knew themselves.
That's right.
It sounds like you're saying the same thing.
Yeah, right.
And as far as your physical condition at this point, were you starting to heal up? Were you still in a lot of pain?
I was in pain. It was slowly subsiding, but I still was in, I had ache pain. I couldn't stand more than a few minutes, you know. Walking was terrible. It was painful to sit down. You just can't escape it. It's with you, you know.
What gave you hope in that situation? Because I'm sure you had to have some hope to keep going.
Yeah, well, you know, it sounds kind of fluky, but... you have to kind of come to grips with yourself, you know, what you're faced with now. And I kind of knew where we were in the war, and, you know, I knew we were winning. And I told myself, well, I'll give it 6 months, you know. And at the end of the 6 months, if nothing's happened, then I'm going to have to do something. You know, I thought, well, I'll wait 6 months, and if I'm still here, I'm going to have to then actively pursue something to get out of here, you know, escape or something. And it happened almost exactly 6 months to where, you know, the war ended.
Yes, the war ended. But there were a lot of things that happened in those 6 months that we really need to explore. So this is going to be one of those rare situations where we stretch an interview over to a second episode of Hometown Heroes. We're going to hear Ray explain what life in a prisoner of war camp was really like, how glorious it was to experience freedom again after living without it for a while, and a couple adventures he's had in the years since that I think you're going to enjoy hearing about as well. I'll look forward to sharing that with you next time, but we're out of time on Hometown Heroes for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.